Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Inner Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes.
In today's episode, we've invited along our friend, Lindsay Claire Hogg, who is doing a PhD in tissue donation in minors.
Yes.
Yes, and you also have the honour of sharing an office with Josh.
She does.
Yes. No comment.
And have been corralled into joining our podcast for today.
Yeah.
No, to be fair, I was actually listening to them on Spotify. And that's where I said to Josh, I was like, oh, I was listening and they were really good. And that's when he said, would you like to do one? And I said, yes.
That's very nice. Or visit our website, innerzonepodcast.com.
I'll have to do that after this.
So another listener guest, which is always good.
Yeah.
So with sharing an office with me, you're in the law department.
Yes, I am.
And so you're looking at the legal issues of tissue donation in minors.
Yes. So, So my PhD is on living minors, as you've already said, and minors are what I call children, because there are, when you think of a child, you think of a very, very young individual, not necessarily a 15 or 16 year old, which is actually, who is actually classed as a child. So I use that term for particular reasons. I look at England and Wales as well as Scotland, so I look at two different jurisdictions. So in Scotland, a minor is under the age of 16, whilst in England and Wales, pardon me, it's under the age of 18. So I look at tissue donation, which incorporates organ donation within it.
Right, because there's a difference between organ donation and tissue donation.
Correct.
Right, and so what, I mean, obviously I don't know anything about this as an outsider. What is the difference between organ and tissue donation?
Okay, so I make this distinction within tissue donation between regenerative tissue and non-regenerative tissue. So regenerative tissue is, as it says on the tin, tissue that will regenerate in the body once it's been removed. So you're looking at blood and bone marrow.
Yeah.
You've got non-regenerative tissue on the other hand, which, like it says, is tissue that doesn't regenerate in the body once it's been removed. So for example, a kidney, you will never grow one back. Unless you're superhuman, but we've not come across any individuals like that. I make this distinction within my PhD around the arguments. So I don't want to call it organ donation, because when you think of organ donation, it doesn't class bone marrow or blood under that
right.
form. But things like kidney can be classed as tissue because it is just classed as non-regenerative tissue. So I've used the term tissue in order to cover everything rather than trying to make this distinction between organs and tissues. But yeah, kidneys are tissue as well.
Right.
To try and make that distinction and make it more clear.
Okay, so cool. Are we talking about living donors here? Or
yeah, only donors? Living donors. So basically a child that is alive when they donate and continue to be alive once they've donated.
And it's all about whether they are able to give consent and the extent of the consent that they can give. Is that right?
It covers a few issues. So I cover all categories, or I split it into categories of child or minor. So I have incompetent minors, so minors that will need those with parental responsibility to consent on their own behalf.
So would that be because they're too young to consent, or because they're sort of mentally challenged?
You don't necessarily look at the age of an individual as to whether they can consent. So for example, Mike when he was 9 might have been able to consent to a medical procedure, whilst Josh when he's 9 might not have been able to consent to a medical procedure.
That's very kind of you.
Because of the level of understanding.
Yeah.
And then the next category that I look at is competent minors. So minors under the age of 16 who do in fact have the required level of understanding within law to be able to consent on behalf of themselves. And then the last category I look at is 16 and 17 year olds, and that's only applicable in England and Wales, and they have different capacity laws and consent laws for themselves.
So going back to that second category, what is the level of understanding required for consent?
So it differs depending on England and Wales compared to Scotland. So in England and Wales you're looking at the Gillick competence test, which came out of the case of Gillick, which was actually a case about contraceptive treatment, but equally applied to all areas, whilst in Scotland it is under Section 2.4 of the Age of Legal Capacity Act 1991.
Yeah, we should probably say that for the purposes of law, England and Wales and Scotland are separate countries, aren't they?
For the purposes of certainly my area, there are some overlaps, but there are two different sets of legislation that govern the use and removal and use of human tissue, as well as two different sets of legislation that deal with capacity and consent.
So, as an outsider, can I butt in? So just to get When you say in Scotland and in Wales and in England, yes. is that nationals, English nationals, or is that you are just in England? If you happen, if I go over the border to Scotland, is it the Scottish law that would apply, or is it because I'm from England? Is it which law would apply?
So for the purposes of what I look at, so living donors,
yeah.
it is what applies in that. So even though you are English, Mike, if you went over to Scotland, the law would apply that's in Scotland.
Right.
For deceased donation, which I don't cover in my PhD, regarding this opt-in, opt-out debate,
yeah.
If you unfortunately passed away in Wales, then the law in Wales wouldn't necessarily apply to you because there are certain...
Be based on where you come from, then.
Yes, for that sort of donation, so, but for living donation, right. it only applies. The law applies to which country you are.
Territorial.
Exactly. Thank you, Josh.
You could technically cross borders then to get around differences in the law. Then, in this case, could you?
Technically, yes, but there are certain requirements in order for you to be able to, in order for a minor to be a tissue donor. So, for example,
right.
you can't just. I only look at sibling-to-sibling donation as well, I should make that clear. So I only look at one sibling donating to another sibling. But, for example, you couldn't just... A family couldn't just turn up and say, look, one of my children needs a kidney, my other child is histocompatible, please remove that kidney from that child and put it in the other child. There are lots of other steps that are required safeguards in order for that to happen.
That's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. So what made you look at just siblings?
So a lot of this argument, so undergoing a tissue donation is a non-therapeutic procedure, so it doesn't benefit the individual medically, it benefits another individual.
The recipient. Yeah.
yeah. So, for example, if you had to have your tonsils removed, Mike, you would undergo a risk of you having to undergo that operation,
yeah.
but ultimately the benefit is for yourself.
Yeah.
Whilst with a tissue donation, they are undergoing a procedure that is going to medically harm them whilst they are receiving no medical benefit. So we rest this justification on the psychological benefit they will receive from donating.
Right.
So this psychological benefit is more likely to materialise if it's a sibling-to-sibling donation because they'll have the benefits of the wider family as well as seeing their sibling grow up, remain alive, an intact family, the arguments go on.
Right.
And I make it clear at the start of my PhD that I only focus on sibling-to-sibling donation because in order for it to proceed, in some cases you have to have Human Tissue Authority approval. Human Tissue Authority is basically a body that regulates the use, removal and retention of human tissue within England, Wales and Scotland for various things, post-mortem examinations, medical research,
right.
and tissue donation as well. And in order for them to approve it, it would be likely that it would have to be a sibling-to-sibling donation because a minor would not necessarily receive that psychological benefit from donating to a complete stranger.
Yeah, so that, so because of that, then minor donations from children, from a child in one family to a child in a different family, that's unlikely to happen at all.
Yeah, that's unlikely to happen. I mean, if there was some sort of connection... So obviously we don't have this idea of a nuclear family, the mother, the father and the two children. We have various conceptions yeah. of what a family is. That will obviously have an impact. And I talked briefly about that in my introduction. I don't go into massive detail.
Right.
But it's what rests on that psychological benefit. Could you determine, yes, there is a chance that that minor will receive a psychological benefit and then...
Right. So say two families are very close and there was two children who could, one could donate to the other, and then that psychological benefit could be present.
Yeah,
in,
I mean,
in a
it'll also.
Way to siblings.
Yeah, I mean, it will also depend on the type of tissue donated. So you've got to look at the risk of the medical
yeah.
risk. So, for example, blood donation is considered a very minor procedure. You know, you don't really have any recovery process and etc. So obviously, you could have a smaller psychological benefit to outweigh the medical risk. While certainly with a kidney donation, you wouldn't want to be giving children's kidneys away just.
Yeah.
Why not to help somebody else?
And it's interesting that the onus there is on the psychological benefit for the child, and not for the like the actual mortal benefit potentially for the receiver.
Hmm.
I mean, a lot of people. I mean, when you look at the academic literature, you've got people that focus on the donor and people that focus on the recipient. I focus on the donor
right.
And make it very clear because ultimately, when again, it goes back to this idea that a tissue donation is different to other types of medical procedures. So again, going back to your removing your tonsils, Mike.
She really wants them tonsils, don't you?
Ultimately, it only focuses on you. It doesn't necessarily have an impact on anybody else.
Yeah.
Whilst because you've got these two individuals that have an impact, it's also going back to this idea that, you know, you can't, those with parental responsibility, consent on behalf of an individual for a procedure that's in their best interests.
Yeah.
And ultimately, conflating these interests of the two individuals can start to muddle this idea of what's in the donor's best interests. And ultimately, yes, it helps the recipient, and yes, it's great for the recipient, and they could stay alive. But ultimately, the individual you need to focus on is it in the donor's best interest? Should the donor undergo that procedure, regardless of the impact it has on the recipient?
Right.
If you go, okay, yes, they might be able to undergo this this procedure, then look at the impact it has on the recipient. And ultimately, if that procedure would never benefit the recipient, then it's futile looking at whether the donor should donate in the first place.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually, yeah.
But ultimately, I'm very much focusing on, sometimes they forget about the interest of the donor. So I found a quote back when they first started this donation transplantation procedures, and it was part of medical research back then. And one of the donors said, look, well, if I undergo this procedure and you remove this kidney from me, will you be able to look after me for the rest of my life if something happens to my other kidney? And they basically said, you're part of the transplant team, you're not, you know, we don't look at your interests, we look at the recipient's interests, and you're just part of this team helping that individual.
Right.
And it was very much seen as that back in the day, whilst, you know, you're seen as helping an individual, you're not seen as looking at your own interests, which I think is very important, especially when it's a child.
Yeah, so that was however long ago. How long ago was that then?
You're looking at most probably around the 50s and 60s time, where they really started to try out these types of different donations and transplantations. And obviously, some procedures have been around for a long time, while some types of donation and transplantation are very recent.
Yeah. So how has that kind of approach sort of changed then?
In what sense?
In the sense that, well, I guess I'm thinking,
you're more focusing on the donor rather than...
Yeah, because it seemed like, you know, a donor's going to turn up, oh, thanks for this organ, oh, I'll see you later. If your remaining kidney fails, oh, that's hard luck. Mm. Whereas now, I presume, I would hope there's...
It's very much changed that. I mean, if you're looking at England, Wales and Scotland, then the first time that living donation was actually explicitly set out in law was 1989,
right,
which is not that long ago.
Recent.
I mean, before then, you had the Human Tissue Act of 1961, which really only covered deceased donations. And then you had some statutes regarding cornea transplants, which obviously could only really occur in deceased individuals. I mean, we had as it all says in my PhD, we had a number of scandals that resulted in these legislation. So we had the kidney sale scandal, which resulted in the 1989 Act, where basically individuals were being flown over from certain parts of the world, or adverts were being placed in certain parts of the world, and individuals were being paid money in order for them to sell their kidney. So the 1989 Act was introduced, and it made selling organs and tissue illegal, and also it introduced some restrictions between genetic individuals and transplanting between the two. And then obviously we had the organ retention scandals, which I don't know if both of you are aware of them, regarding older hay and the removal and retention use of children's organs, or sometimes just storage of, within hospitals and other institutions, which led to what we now have, the Human Tissue Act 2004 and the Human Tissue Scotland Act 2006.
And I assume obviously these acts are always changing, because obviously the technology is changing over time. As you say, there's new procedures now that they weren't in the past. I mean, I've got two sort of broad questions to sort of throw your way. I mean, the first one that sort of builds on what you were mentioning there was, obviously we're going towards a phase where we're going to be able to grow organs very soon. I mean, how does that fit into sort of your research? How much longer do you think organ transplantation in minors will be a thing?
I mean, it's always going to be a thing. I mean, unfortunately, we need organs, and we need organs more than we've ever needed organs. And we always have this, you know, we need more than we can get, the supply and demand. I mean, hopefully with the change in 2020 of the law regarding deceased organ donation.
So what's that change going to be?
So it goes from an opt-in to an opt-out system, which is what Wales have. So basically, nowadays we can go, okay, we want to put our name on the list in order to donate our organs once we've passed away, whilst the law will change, so you're automatically on the list unless you opt out, and then you can select which types of organs you can donate. I mean, also looking at the different types, Mike, you were saying about this advancement, so not all types of organs can be automatically donated, so you've right. got like novel ones and then like standard ones. So your novel ones are looking at like your wombs and your brain and things like this, whilst your standard ones are looking at bone marrow, heart, lung, things like that once you've passed away. As to whether we will always need donation and transplantation in the normal sense that we're talking about at the moment, there are ways in order to gain these organs without using this traditional procedure. So, for example, you have xenotransplantation, where you can use organs and tissues from animals.
Yeah, I was going to say, because there used to be that children's TV show called Pig Heart Boy, didn't there?
Yes.
I don't know about this program.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's quite self-explanatory into what we were about.
But yeah, one of my supervisors did her PhD on xenotransplantation.
Oh, right.
I mean, they also think about now 3D printing. You can 3D print? Well, you can tissue match. So obviously we have a problem with tissue match, which used to be a bigger problem than what it is now, because rejection medicine has advanced a lot. So back in the day, it used to be only twin-to-twin donations that would be successful, whilst nowadays you can have less matched individuals. But obviously, if you took my tissue profile and was able to input it into a computer or some sort of device and then print me a new kidney that would be fully functioning, obviously that would somewhat resolve some of our issues. But I think that sort of technology is very far in advance. But it's certainly ideas of things you need to consider in the future.
So the other thing that came up as you were sort of talking, really, was this thing about designer babies. And especially with regards to the law and people that have babies to save an existing child. Because I mean, to me, that feels a bit ethically dubious if someone's being brought into the world just to donate. So therefore, you're not psychologically benefiting them, because their whole life has been created just so that they can hopefully benefit this other child.
Well, another thing I put in my PhD introduction is that I only consider children that are currently alive.
Right, yeah.
So ones that have been born because they were born and then are considered donors. Mm. And this idea of save your siblings is a massive thing regarding whatever you're using them for. But again, I don't consider that, because that's a whole another ethical debate that could be a whole PhD in itself that I wish to tackle, but I am aware of that, but I don't necessarily address that directly in my PhD.
I mean, have you got any thoughts on it? I know it's not your research, so I'm opening this a bit more widely to Josh as well. I mean, because it's an interesting one, isn't it?
Well, I suppose it depends upon whether that's the only reason.
That you bring them into the world?
Yeah. Because to me, it would be very cynical for somebody for that to be the only reason.
Yeah.
You know, I've had this child A is dying, and I'm going to have child B purely to save child A. That seems very cynical. Whereas if it's, oh, child A is really ill and he's going to die, and oh, but we happen to have child B, and that's just quite convenient.
But there's also the other thing that, so you've got child A that's really ill, and then you go, okay, I'm going to have child B, and then whilst it's in the womb, you know, whilst the lady is pregnant, they work out whether it's going to be a tissue match, and they say no, then that's when they abort.
Ooh.
And then that issue comes in.
I hadn't even thought of that,
should you abort it in order to try again to see if you can get a child that is a tissue match?
Or if child A dies in the process while you're pregnant.
Oh, God.
Wow, you know, I hadn't even thought about it that way. Yeah, so it's pretty dystopian, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
So there are lots of ethical issues. I mean, you could do a PhD around abortion and then looking at that aspect of it regarding uses of the child for the future. But I am not an abortion law specialist by any means.
That's absolutely fascinating, isn't it? Because it ties in with lots of other sort of abortion-related debates, like sort of you have sort of people aborting, like sort of girls or boys, or based on gender, or especially as we become more advanced at profiling as well.
Genetic profiling. I mean, there's some pretty horrible stories about babies being aborted, fetuses being aborted because they've got sort of a minor disability that could just be solved, you know, in a 2-hour operation once it's born or something like that. But going back to kind of to designer babies.
It's genetic profiling, like.
Yeah.
But then you could change, sorry to interrupt, but you could change it so you could go, okay, well, I want a child with blue eyes, I want a child with blonde hair, or I want a child that's going to be 6 foot tall. I obviously didn't get that gene.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I suppose it depends, it goes, I was thinking about this, or reading about this the other day, in terms of, there's ideas of positive eugenics and negative eugenics. So apparently the guy who invented eugenics thought about it in terms of, oh, we'll get, wouldn't it be really good if two amazing scientists got together, or two amazing artists, and then they had this extra amazing child, and that would be really positive for the human race. And that's his basic thinking. And then obviously it's not very difficult to turn that around and say, okay, well, we won't allow these two degenerate people to get together because they'll have an extra degenerate child. So I think with designer babies, it sort of poses that question of whether we can make about... reposes the question about making people extraordinary on purpose.
I mean, obviously, I think we're going to talk about that a little bit in another podcast, which listeners can look forward to. It talks about human enhancement, but you're absolutely right. It's an ethical minefield, I think, isn't it? As much as anything, because it's like, well, what does it say about the human race, and what does it say about what we value? Because I can certainly imagine it wouldn't necessarily be intelligence that would be the first thing people look for in their kids, would it?
No, that's why I mentioned blue.
Blue eyes. Yeah.
But the thing is you could use it for the greater good, and you could, you know, certainly with problems within medicine, and certainly this idea that, you know, we live in the 21st century and we have all these amazing things we can do now, but yet we still have a shortage of organs and a shortage of tissue, and even though medical technology is advancing at a massive rate, it's not advancing fast enough for the human race. Yeah, you could use it, you know, for amazing things, and could you, you know, create individuals that are going to be a tissue match for certain individuals to help. Sure, I'm not saying that's the thing to do or the right thing, but it could be used for good. And yet, a lot of times it's not. It's used for bad or evil, or however you want to phrase it. And that's the problem with these things.
So, going back to sort of your central research, isn't
it? Yeah, because we're completely off the central research trail.
Because it's all really interesting. That's sort of the point of our podcast, I think, just sort of having interesting chats about things. I mean, I was just thinking about what happens when these minors change their minds. Can they change their minds when you're looking at consent?
So basically, obviously, an incompetent minor, so a minor that can't consent on by themselves, they have to have those with parental responsibility consenting on their behalf.
Yeah.
Then you obviously got competent minors that can consent for themselves. As you're looking for change of their mind, they say that anyone can change their mind about a medical procedure up until the medical procedure is being performed.
Yeah.
So for example, I could say, going back to your tonsils, you could go, yes, I'm going to have it, yes, I'm going to have it, yes, I'm going to have it. Right, 1 second before I'm going to take them out, no, I'm not going to have it. And that's it. And as long as you're making it...
until that second.
And it's until... For tissue and organ donation, it's up until the item is removed. So the organ or the tissue
but
is removed.
There's a bit of a grey area there, isn't there, if you're under anaesthetic.
There's
a point between going under and... But maybe if you...
It's too late then.
Yeah, so like if Josh is my son and Josh is giving his kidney to you...
And thanks very much,
Josh is having second thoughts. But I'm like, oh no, Josh is having second thoughts. Quick, anaesthetise him.
Yeah, that wouldn't quite be classed as legal.
No, but how you wouldn't necessarily know in the eyes of the law, it's where at what point does it not become legal? Is it because he's having second thoughts?
Well, no, it's once you've consented, you can remove that consent at any time. Like I said, up until the removal. I mean, as to where that line will it appears, it depends on the situation. So, for example, if I was Josh's surgeon and I was going to remove that kidney, not by the way.
It's my kidney.
I could say, just before he goes into the operation, under the anaesthetic, I could say, Josh, do you definitely want to undergo, you know, and just double make sure. I mean, it's not necessarily a clear cut in the sense that he goes, right, I am consenting to this, end of, and that's the end of the conversation. It's a process consent.
Yeah.
And there's continual communication between Josh and his medical team. So when you're a donor and when you're a recipient, you have two sets of medical professionals, one that deals with the donor and one that deals with the recipient.
Mm.
You also, in some situations, have to undergo interviews with certain individuals, so independent assessors or accredited assessors. And then they will discuss with the donor and the recipient various factors as well. So to some extent, you will have some sort of understanding. And and whether there's this continual unease. So they've consented, but you can sort of gain an understanding that they didn't really want to consent, or there are issues, then they may be raised, and obviously if there are massive problems, it will be sent to court. And then they will make the final decision of whether Josh will undergo this procedure or not.
Yeah.
But it's the sense that ultimately, for example, if you were going to undergo a blood donation,
yeah,
and I was right up to inserting the needle and you go, actually, no, I'm not going to do it, as long as you're making a capacity decision.
Then yeah, I mean, that one's an interesting one, just because needles are quite scary. And I imagine kids would probably freak out as soon as they saw a needle or something like that. But I'm just thinking as well, what when they get this consent, do they ensure the parents are separate to the child? Because I'm wondering just about sort of coercion almost, or because obviously the thing with consent is, I mean, you get this with adults with mental health problems as well. I mean, my sister worked in hospital and we're aware of sort of this incapacity. I wonder, is there also an element to which the parents need to be separated from the minor when it comes to informed consent? And
yeah, so the donor minor, like I said, will undergo an interview with an independent assessor, accredited right. assessor, depending on the type of tissue being donated, and that will be on their own.
Right.
And the individual is trained in addressing the individual depending on their level of understanding and the type of... And even if they don't have capacity, if they're not competent, then that individual still undergoes an interview.
Yeah, they still have it explained.
It might be done in like play terms and various things.
Like, this is what it means.
Exactly. Yeah. And there are, like they said, they have a separate medical team compared to the recipient, and they undergo a separate interview, as well as they, in some situations, they undergo an interview together. So the donor and the recipient, as well as a separate interview, are put in the same room and interviewed together to see the sort of relationship that they have and to see whether there are issues with duress and coercion and also reward and money and things like that. And so I'm not saying the system is perfect, but there are quite a few safeguards, as well as those reports are then sent off to the Human Tissue Authority, and then they determine in some circumstances. I know I keep putting this caveat in, but it depends on the type of tissue, and depends on whether they're competent or not. And it gets sent off to the Human Tissue Authority, and then they decide. And then in some situations, they will have to have court approval as well.
On the court approval thing, I was going to say, could you explain for our listeners why it needs to go to court? Because a lot of people would think it's nothing to do... Why is it going to court? It's just to do with the parents, basically.
So, court approval is required, certainly, from what I can remember, when it is a solid organ or non-regenerative tissue, so a kidney. And I'm pretty sure it's in the case of... I can't remember if it's incompetent and competent, or just one of them. But it's basically applicable for when it's a solid organ or non-regenerative tissue. And it goes to court because it is deemed to be... Even if those with parental responsibility have consented, and even if the medical professionals are happy for it to go forward, or if the donor was competent, even if they've consented, then it still goes to court because it's seen as such a serious procedure that it has to have that extra safeguard check, in the sense that they just determine that it's in the best interests of the child, that there aren't issues with coercion or duress. As to when it's not expressly required, it will go to court, for example, if there is an issue. So, for example, Mike and I are your parents, Josh.
Yeah. And, I can see that.
And Mike is like, I'm all up for giving away Josh's kidney. And I say, not a chance are you cutting the kidney out of my
fight
son.
Over his kidney. Yeah.
Then, obviously, if you've got an issue, then it would have to go to court in order to resolve that issue. The other situation is where the medical professionals think one thing and the parents think another. So, for example, if we go, yes, we do want Josh's kidney to be removed, and the medical professionals say no, then again, if there's an issue, then that might be taken to court.
Who funds that? So I'm just wondering about, as you say, sort of patient protection and stuff. So if there is a problem, is that just sort of funded by the taxpayer, or does the aggrieved party have to fund that?
It depends what situation. So obviously if it's the standard court approval,
right,
then it's not necessarily an argument between them. So standard court approval is the medical professionals or the individuals or whoever will take it to court and go, look, do you approve this? And they go yes or no. It's not an argument between the two.
Standard court approval.
Okay, yeah. So where it's actually explicitly required. But regarding whether it's an issue between the two, then that will depend on the sort of types of issue, whether it's an issue between the medical professional and the individuals and the parents, or between the parents, or what.
Yeah, because I was just wondering really in terms of whether there might be some sort of financial incentive or disincentive to take it to court in that case, I wonder if the finance would then come into it. Say you and I were had a disagreement over whether Josh gives up his kidney. Like
my valuable, valuable kidney.
Is the onus on me to come up with some money to pay for a court judgment on whether or not it happens? Or just because that doesn't protect Josh, does it? That's...
Yeah, I mean, I don't think finance is necessarily an issue within this. I mean, obviously you have the issue within reward. For example, if we said, Josh, I would give you £3,000 if you give me your kidney. Yeah. So that's not the issue. That's all it's worth. I've seen what you eat for lunch or drink.
Oh, cheers, thanks.
But the thing is it's not necessarily that. I think ultimately when it does hit court, if it has to go to court, the issue is down. It's Josh's interest that we'll look at, the donor's focus. And I think the rest of that in these sorts of cases sort of goes out the window, and it's not necessarily about finance.
Yeah, and I was just wondering if that came into it, because I'm not from a legal background, so...
I'll probably be legal aid and various other things.
Yeah, I mean, the Human Tissue Authority might have something to do with it as well, because obviously they're the regulatory body, and they will obviously have an opinion on this because they will have to give approval as well, so they will obviously be able to make their point as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're coming towards the end of our podcast. I just wondered, what sort of conclusions do you sort of come to in your PhD without giving it away, or maybe without? Maybe that's the point. Where does this leave us from your research? Would you say?
So I recommend a number of reforms.
Right.
So in some aspects, I'm arguing that England, Wales should adopt some approaches that happen in Scotland, and equally I'm saying that some terminology used in England and Wales should be used in Scotland. I also look at the codes of practice. So as well as the statutes, we have reams and reams of codes of practice that the medical professionals will read and have to apply, and those are the things that are changed regularly. Mm. We brought a new set out in, I want to say, 2016 or a bit later maybe, since I started my PhD. So I talk about reforms within those and discuss that.
Okay.
And I also look at, sometimes it's just clarification. So there is very little, in fact, no case law on looking at children as organ donors. We have cases on adults that are incompetent donating, but not children. So we have a number of issues regarding just clarity and clarifying it in some aspects that is required.
Oh, it's really interesting.
But I'm not letting the cat out of the bag. I'm not telling you exactly what I'm going to say. You'll have to wait for that.
That's very interesting.
Oh, fascinating stuff.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Lindsay.
No problem.
Very interesting. So, thank you
very much.
Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit InTheZonePodcast.com.